About time to begin here today. This session, if we're all in the right place, is to look at how employment and education influence Mormon women's church activity. I want to note that this session is sponsored by the Society for the Sociological Study of Mormon Life. Any of you who might be interested in membership in that organization, Tim Heaton, to my right, would be glad to take your name. We have a newsletter that comes out a couple of times a year, and it's a small fledgling organization. But we are working, and hopefully by next year we'll have a book out on the sociology of Mormonism published by the University of Illinois Press, and so we hope you all look for that. Today's session is an attempt to look at Mormon women's experience with employment and education. We are all sociologists. Tim and Martha are both smarter than I am, though, so they're going to present today. Now, let me give you some background about these two people and why they're able to do this. Tim Heaton is a university demographer, which means he likes to count how many women go to work and how many children they have and what age they get married and all sorts of things. Tim has done more for the demography of Mormonism than any other human being alive, right? At this point. So if you want to know anything about the demographics of Mormons, Tim Heaton's the person to ask. So he's going to be the counter today. He's going to count beans and tell us all about percentages. Then to get a fuller perspective on life, we've asked Martha Beck to come and fill in that view with some qualitative information. Martha Beck is our best hope for the future in the sociology of Mormonism. She's written a wonderful dissertation on Mormon women for the Harvard, and is at this point a Ph. We think she still got to get that. The D is on its way. Yeah, the dissertation is written and in the hands of her professors, and we're hoping to have a congratulatory party soon. But Martha has been teaching in the Department of Sociology at BYU half-time for us, and we're glad to have her, and we're really glad of her interest in researching Mormon women and their experience. So with that, I'll turn the time over first to Tim and his counting, and then we'll have some information from Martha.
For me. You don't have to march back and forth. Striking a balance between accommodating to broader society and maintaining a sense of uniqueness has been a persistent challenge to Mormonism. Often new religious movements, the way they create a sense of uniqueness is to challenge the existing economic order and to emphasize otherworldly rewards, things you get in heaven. This hasn't always been true for Mormons. Economic achievement, seems to me, was always part of the Mormon experience. Now, Mormons did have other ways where they were at tension with broader society and had some sense of uniqueness. Their sense of community solidarity, they didn't have a good sense of separation of church and state. Things like polygamy also created tension with society. But Mormonism from its inception had an economic agenda, including success in the world. That was evident in Missouri and Nauvoo and in Utah when they settled. So part of my hypothesis is doing well in worldly ways is and has been an important part of Mormonism. But we've maintained distinctiveness in other ways. In contemporary Mormonism, we see that economic success is still valued. People who achieve well have their names on buildings at BYU. Many of the general authorities are drawn from the ranks of successful businessmen and lawyers. And at the ward level, it seems like people who get the most salient positions, certainly the men, have done well economically on the average. And as I've noted in other research with Stan Albrecht, there's a positive relationship between education and church attendance. So even in modern Mormonism, the doing well economically seems to be very compatible with being a religious participating Mormon. For women, that was mostly for men. Now for women, it's less certain. We don't know near enough about Mormon women's contribution to the economy in the early church. Certainly it was a substantial contribution. Many women had to provide for their families as their husbands were on missions or they were widows or sometimes their husband was a polygamist and was not in the household or for whatever reason, women did maintain households economically. And women's organizations and collectively, women were called on to produce things like silk, to save grain, to not consume goods that were expensive, and so on. So we have some sense that women played an important role in the economy, but I'm sure we don't fully understand that. Now, in the 20th century, certainly since the 1960s, it seems that things have been made more complicated by shifts in the national economy. And in 20th century Mormonism, the role emphasized for women now is the role, the familiar role of wife and mother. Some statements explicitly exclude gainful employment as a legitimate role for women. Other statements, though, and probably the predominant mode of discourse says women's role is wife and mother, and paints that as the primary role. Now let's come back to this this issue of accommodation and uniqueness then. It seems that given the history of the church, in some ways it would that Mormons have accommodated economically. But we're emphasizing for women an area of uniqueness, that is that the most salient role throughout their life, or certainly adult life, is wife and mother. What I want to explore with my charts then are how this issue between family roles, economic roles, and church activity are resolved for Mormon women. What are the conflicts and compatibilities? So what I want to do is look at the relationships among economic roles, employment and educational achievement, familial roles, marriage and parenthood, and church roles. And there I'll look at frequency of church attendance. And we'll find some interesting results. Before we get to those, though, let me say a little bit about the information I have. National samples now, there are enough Mormons that when we do national studies, we get some Mormons, not quite enough. So I've cheated a little bit and combined three different surveys. Done in the 1980s. These are national probability samples. By combining the three studies, I have over 400 Mormon women that I can compare with women nationally. Now, two of the three surveys are exclusively of women. This is designed by national agencies. And so all I analyze are women. Last year I was accused of disparaging Mormon women, because I talked only about women. I want you to know that's not my intent, but that's the limitation I have because of the information available. Also, I don't want to disparage anyone, regardless of what data I have. So let's look at some numbers. As Marie said, this is what I like to do. So could you turn on the chart for us? This one is kind of an overview, and then we'll get to these in more detail. Here we have the correlations between various characteristics, and kind of up in this corner we have Mormons up above the ones, and down in the other corner we have women in the United States. Looking across that first row, let me define the characteristics. Working full-time. Okay, so you see the... Okay. Okay. Characteristics are, do you work full-time, yes or no? Do you work part-time, yes or no? How many years of education have you completed? Are you married? How many children would you like to have? And how often do you go to church? Those are the characteristics. Okay, we'll see for Mormons that, looking across the first row, and this makes sense, women who work full-time don't work part-time. Wow. Well, I'm not very good at this, Marie. It takes me a whole semester. Okay. Thank you. But they're negative, Marie. Some are negative. Okay. So the second number over there, we see that the number is positive. That means the more education you have, the more likely you are to work full-time. Now, if there were a perfect relationship, the number would be 1, but it's only 0.1. So this is a pretty small relationship here, a small tendency. Now, the next number is negative. Means if you work full-time, you're less likely to be married. Or you could say that the other way around. If you're married, you're less likely to work full-time. Next number is negative. If you work full-time, you want fewer children. Or you could say that the other way. If you want more children, you're less likely to work full-time. And finally, if you work full-time, you go to church less often. Just for fun, let's look at the same numbers going down. Now that's for women nationally. We can skip the first one. It's not that interesting. Skip that one. Okay, this is the same thing. The more education, the more likely you are to work full-time, but it's larger in the nation than it is for Mormons. Okay, next number. Virtually no relationship between marital status and working full-time nationally, but a noticeably large relationship. Okay, next one. Children desired, similar pattern. Hardly any there's a little bit of a negative relationship nationally, but a larger negative relationship for Mormons. Next number. For Mormons working full-time and going to church, there's some incompatibility there. Hardly any incompatibility in the national sample. So Mormons are different. Now, if we looked the same way at the same row and column for part-time work, we would find part-time work has hardly any relationship to marriage, desired children, or church attendance for Mormon women, and not much for women nationally. As you might expect, marriage and having children have a higher positive relationship with church attendance for Mormons than is the case nationally. And one last area of interest. Now, we sort of saw here, and we'll go over this again if you're lost. We saw that working full-time seems to be incompatible with family and church for Mormons. But now look at the education effect. positive correlation between education and marriage for Mormons, about the same relationship for everyone else. A slight negative relationship between education and children for Mormons, virtually zero. But a noticeable negative relationship nationally. And finally, for Mormon women, a fairly strong positive relationship between education and church attendance for Mormons, and virtually no relationship nationally. Let's go over these in detail so you can see the pattern a little better. This is kind of an overview. Let's put up the first chart, Marie. Those were summary measures. Okay, this one is employment patterns. Overall, Mormon women are about as likely to be gainfully employed, 54.5%, as are women nationally, 56%. Virtually no difference. But there is a difference because Mormons are more likely to work part-time. That's the blue part of the line. Compared to women nationally. But now you see another interesting difference. Mormon married women are a little less likely to work than married women nationally. But married single women, I'm sorry, wait, what am I saying? Mormon single women. Married. Thank you. Sorry about the bottom line there. Okay, so the first bar is Mormon married women. The next is Mormon single women, then nationally married women and nationally single women. It's the last. So Mormon married women are less likely to work than other married women, but Mormon single women are more likely to work. Now, a little side point here. If I understand the church's advice, you're supposed to be self-sufficient. So, for example, single women, they should work and try and provide for themselves. And if you look at this chart, you would say that's right. The single women from our Mormons are more likely. But for married women, some of the church advises they shouldn't work. And we can see that married women here are less likely to work if they're Mormons than if they're not. So just an overall equal rate of employment for the two groups does not mean necessarily that Mormon women ignore advice they get from the pulpit. In fact, in this case, it may mean they're following that advice to some degree. Okay, let's look at the second chart. We already saw this. The more education, the more likely to work, especially to work full-time. But the difference between those with less than 12 years of schooling and those with 16 or more years of schooling, for example, if you look at that LDS difference, it's about 22 percentage points. Now, that's a big... I'm looking at full-time work now. That's a big difference. Mormon women with at least a college degree are twice as likely to work as Mormon women without a high school degree. Some of that, I'm sure, is an age effect, but some of it is... Because the women without a high school degree are much older on average. But a substantial part of that is an education effect. On the other hand, the difference is larger for women nationally. The correlation between education and employment is greater. Okay, let's look at the next chart. As we kind of saw from the correlations, it doesn't make much difference whether you work or not, how many children you want nationally. But for Mormons, it does make a difference. Full-time employed women want fewer children. Now, they still want more children than any of the women nationally, regardless of their working pattern, but they want fewer children than the women who work either part-time or not at all. Okay, let's look at the next chart. Very interesting pattern here. Virtually no relationship between education and how many children you would like to have among Mormons. Again, the ones with less than 12 years of schooling want a little bit larger families, but I suspect all of that is an age effect and not an education effect. On the other hand, nationally, we see a decline and the number of children you would like to have as people get more education. Okay, next chart. Church attendance. We see the other, that is nationally, we see a slight decline in church attendance among women who work full-time, but not really a big difference. For Mormons, on the other hand, we see a substantial difference. Again, though, Mormon women who work full-time go to church more than groups of women nationally, regardless of their employment status. But there does appear to be some incompatibility between full-time work and church attendance. Okay. Last chart in the relationship I find very interesting. Hardly any relationship between education and frequency of church attendance nationally, but a very strong relationship among Mormons. Mormon women with 16 or more years of schooling are much more likely to attend church regularly than women without college experience. So there are the numbers. Have I still got a few minutes? Okay. We've seen important differences. Let me summarize what I see the difference to be. That is, and I had the lines drawn, economic, social achievement versus family. But that's not the right line to draw. Because education, an area of social achievement, is very compatible with family and church experience, church participation for Mormons. But full-time employment is a little less compatible. And that I'm still not sure I understand that. Why would education detract from family and church among Mormons, but not do so nationally? Some of it might have to do with the demands of church and family. Mormons, as we saw, want larger families, and that may create more conflict with full-time employment, and they go to church more often. That may create more conflict. It also may be that the official statements by the church discouraging employment some alienation among full-time working women, and they feel less accepted in their church. One other point. Suppose I were telling the church how to maximize church attendance. What should I say? Should I tell women? Should I tell them, encourage women to go to college, or should I tell them, encourage women not to work? Well, the education effect is bigger than the work effect, so I'd be better off just in terms of attendance to say, go to school, get a college degree. But what if we try to get everything and tell them both, get a college degree but don't work? What would happen? You can see there is some correlation between working and education, so that might not work very well anyway. But a colleague, Boyd Rollins' research, shows that women who are most likely to abuse their children are college-educated women who stay home with young children. So those two roles may create some frustration and some incompatibility in roles that would not be accepted. Well, I've done my share. We'll have Martha come up and give a... This is self-report. What did I say on the chart? It's weekly?
Yeah.
They say they go to church every week. So that would be frequent church attendance. I would say more about it, but I'm not with it. It's a study of Utah. It's a random sample of Utahns. The response rate wasn't real great. It's a study done in about, when did Boyd do that? 1986? Yes, and about 55% of the people sent it back. Well,
for a demographer, that's low. For a survey, that's good.
It's good for a survey, but the numbers I've shown you, it's more like 90% because they sent an interviewer around.
Generalized.
I wouldn't put it up as the truth necessarily, but I would say there's really a potential issue there. Now, I agree completely, but Mormon women's occupations are quite similar to women's occupations nationally. So what you're saying is true, but it wouldn't explain the difference between Mormons and other people. The question is, she understands that the group leaving the church most frequently are young, educated women. Martha probably can say more about that than I can, though I will say I haven't seen good statistics that indicate that, so I'm not quite ready to accept it yet.
Okay, you're all starting to ask the very questions that make me not a demographer. Demographer is one word to call it. Other words that sociologists use to refer to people who do the kind of work that Tim does are quant jock, number cruncher, or data masseuse. Masseuse because of the process known as massaging the data, which is when you take a set of numbers and try to force them to conform to your theory. Tim doesn't do that. He actually does very, very good work and very clear quantitative work, but it is quantitative. And some of the qualitative sociologists like myself, one qualitative sociologist once said that statistics are people with the tears washed off. And that applies to all other emotions and thoughts as well, that when you look at a set of numbers, they can tell you a story, they can tell you a very interesting story, and they can tell it to you in a way that is very solid, that gives you some real assurance that you're on the right track. But they can tell different stories. I'll never forget sitting in a lecture at Harvard with my jaw dropping to the floor as a Danish professor put forth the idea that the truly liberated women in the first half of the 20th century in the United States were black because they had the freedom to work at higher levels than white women. Numerically, she had a very solid case. If she had read about or talked to any of these women who had been, these African-American women who'd been at work during this period, she would have found that they didn't feel very liberated. They were leaving their own kids to take care of white women's kids. They were leaving their own laundry to take care of white women's laundry. And they didn't feel liberated from the home. And certainly the white women seem to have had a lot more actual time and leisure at their disposal. So the numbers can't tell you everything. And the role of a qualitative sociologist is to go out and talk to people and hear the stories and figure out, why are you doing this? And you've already started giving some of this information. You see a set of numbers and you start to think, why is that true? Why aren't they going? Maybe it's because, I know a story about, there are six women I know who don't go to church because they're working in the ICU on Sunday, and so on. And so to get a broader picture of what these numbers might mean, Tim asked me to come participate. I've spent the last, it seems like a lifetime now, interviewing about 300 LDS women for my dissertation, and I was interviewing them on role conflict. It wasn't specifically targeted at the topics, at the very numbers that Tim has mentioned today, but it was very closely related. And so when he gave me his results, I went back to my interview data and culled through those interviews and looked at what women had actually said to me that might help explain why these numbers were coming out and what it might mean. They're very interesting to me, just as they stand, but they do raise these questions. What's going to happen? Why is this going on? And what does it tell me about the future of my organization, my religion, and my own life? And as I looked through the interviews, I found that Tim's data helped bring out a lot of trends and patterns that I hadn't seen before, which are very interesting to me and which I hope to pass on to you today. To figure out what's happening with the church and what's going to happen in terms of the role of women, you first have to understand that we have a church which has a dual system of rewards, especially for women. We come from a culture in which the individual and the rights of the individual to achieve personal fulfillment and achievement, even at the expense of other people, that is defended in our Constitution. And it's defended in our philosophical ideology of governance. We also come from a culture in which the structures are set up very much to support the idea that the group, especially the family, is preeminent, and that individuals should be willing to sacrifice themselves, if necessary, to some degree, to maintain the harmony and success of the group, again, particularly the family. Now, this is more true for women than it is for men, and that's true in American society generally. When the framers of the Constitution wrote down that, or the Declaration of Independence wrote that all men are created equal, they literally meant all white, property-owning males. They did not mean all individuals. They considered philosophically, the philosophical basis of the Declaration of Independence holds that women and people of color are simply incapable of rational thought on an equal basis with the people who were writing the theory, in other words, white male academics in the 17th century in Europe. And so these people of color, women, servants, other people who were in lower social stations, were not given the same kinds of sets of rights and expectations when the United States was framed. Therefore, we have a dual set of expectations. On one hand, we have a fine, rational idea that says we are all created equal, and that appeals to everyone who's ever felt any kind of competitiveness or desire or individual aspiration of any kind. On the other hand, we have a set of structures and attitudes based on the idea that all individuals to some extent, and some individuals to a very large extent, must give up their pursuit of individual satisfaction in order to serve the group. For a long time in the United States, that had a lot to do with race. We're trying to get rid of that. And for even longer, it had to do with gender. And now people are trying to get rid of that, too. But there are expectations on both sides, especially for women, that you have to be there for your family, that the family is very important, that the family is the unit of society. And on the other hand, that the individual is the unit of society, that you have to pursue your own accomplishments, that that's where your essential worth lies. You have to prove yourself in competition with other individuals. Okay, in the church, I think partly because the church was set up in an environment where this grand experiment was taking place, these values got absorbed, and in fact they got sanctified. Instead of just being part of an ideology or a pattern of thought subject to revision, a lot of the structural things that have to do with family and women's position in it, and a lot of the sort of ideal things that had to do with the equality of individuals, both those things got codified as sacred for us. Okay? This creates a really strong conflict for a lot of Mormons, and again, especially for women, because both these sets of inimical values are considered to be eternal truths. And, you know, I don't have a solution for which is right or which is wrong, because I happen to have strong beliefs in both camps. So I'm just like the rest of the majority of the church. But when you, this is all very nice to talk about in theory. What does it mean in practice? What does it mean when you get to things like women in the workforce, women in education, women trying to figure out what's more important to them, their educations, their careers, their families, their husbands, church attendance, you know, career aspirations? What does it actually boil down to? And Tim's data, some of the things that they say are that LDS women do in fact work at a rate very comparable, on the average, to non-LDS women, that education and the church seem to work together, that high education seems to be a real good thing for women who are active in the church, or, and this I think may be part of the explanation for this, women who are very active in the church are likely to pursue education because of their church aspirations. Okay? When I speak at the BYU Women's Conference, I've been on a lot of panels down there, and every single time, the way the members of the panel are listed in the program is, it looks like a resume. It's always in terms of achievements, academic degrees, job titles, so forth. And a lot of the women are kind of wary of that because they feel that they're supposed to be a role model for women to stay home and take care of their kids. You know, and it's really ironic that the people we choose. I talked to one of the leaders in one of the women's auxiliaries as part of my interviews, and she said, I get up every morning, I put on a suit, I go to an office, I sit down, and I write documents about how women should stay home with their children. You know, it just, it doesn't make sense. But the church does reward academic achievement. I mean, when I got accepted to Harvard at 17, I was the youth speaker at every state fireside for a month. You know, I was being held up as a role model, and I just thought it was wonderful. I got all kinds of strokes from church leaders at the local level and even at the, you know, the top church leader level. They always pat me on the head and say, "You're wonderful. You're setting a great example." Okay, so the church does reward that. On the other hand, work in church, full-time work in church, seem to create some kind of conflict. And again, the causality is not perfectly clear from Tim's data. Either people who work full-time stop going to church, or people who don't like church get full-time jobs. Maybe a little of both. You really can't tell which direction the causality runs on that, but one thing is clear, and that is that there is a negative correlation between full-time work for LDS women and church activity. And that means that if you're working full-time, you're not going to church as much. Well, looking at these numbers and trying to explain them and make them tell a story to me in terms of my interviews, I went back and I leafed through all these hundreds and hundreds of pages, hundreds of hours of recorded interviews. And what I found is that LDS women are not as much a composite as they appear to be given numerical averages. That the attitudes among Mormon women about work and family, about the conflict between them, about what they plan to do in the future, that those things differ from one woman to another, and they also differ from one group of women to another, and the way that they differ is in terms of the women's age. And what I came to see is that a large proportion of this attitudinal difference comes from the fact that these women have matured and been socialized during a period of unprecedented and immense social change regarding the role of women. And that it is very difficult to say that a woman who is 20 years old now can have attitudes anything like a woman who was 20 years old in 1950. They work. Yes, they work. There are economic conditions which now prompt a lot of women to go into the workforce. They're the same for us as they are for non-Mormons. And so women do go in, but they go in with very different attitudes and very different beliefs and different plans and expectations, which has a lot to do with what they'll do in the future. And so that's what I want to talk about a little bit. I sort of made a little graph based on how old my interview subjects were at different points on the calendar over the last 50 years or so, and what was happening to them when they were being socialized as women. And when they were young girls or teenagers being socialized, being trained as to what they should do during their adult lives. And I broke that down into different categories that emerged from my interviews. There were different ways that people talked about work, family, and the conflict between them, depending on how old they were. And there were commonalities between women in the same age groups. And it sort of broke down like this. Women who were born in about 1930 to 1955, sorry, I have it, it's a little confusing here. Anyway, women who are now 45 to 60 years old. They were socialized during a period when they were simply taught that women are to stay at home. It wasn't oppressively forced on them, as far as I can tell from the interviews. It was just assumed. It was part of the familiar pattern of American life. There was not any huge movement to stop it. There had been suffrage movements and various increases in a push toward equality in women's roles with men's. And that had been increasing since the beginning of the century. But essentially for the Mormon women I talked to, they were living in a society that was completely founded in pioneer values, very traditional, somewhat insulated, most of them, because these women, remember, the church was not nearly as big back then, and most of them lived in Utah. When they were growing up. And they just assumed a certain role. Now, in about the women who are about 35 to 45 now, in other words, who were who they would have been born in about 1955 to 1965, they were being socialized. They were in high school. They were, you know, 10, 12, 15 years old. During that period from about 1955 to 1965, when there was a sudden and marked change in the attitudes toward women in the broader American community. Now, after World War II, of course, the trend toward women's equality, women's liberation, dropped sharply. Perhaps this was because of the trauma of the war, and not just the war, but the Depression years which preceded it. A very traumatic period in American history, and following World War II with the newfound economic prosperity, there was a kind of retrenchment to a cozy picture of the family, you know, where, you know, women take care of things. It's home and hearth. You almost got the feeling that the whole society was coming home from war and just wanted to cuddle for a while. And women's roles were more stereotypically traditional, less assertive, less individualistic than they had been actually for several years before the war. Then in the 1960s, you had the phenomenon known as the feminine mystique, the famous book by Betty Friedan, which said that all the women who had gone back home to cuddle after World War II were now getting really, really depressed and unhappy with their circumstances. The family structure had changed, so these women were more isolated than they had been prior to World War II. They had higher ideals of family behavior. They also had higher education and felt more frustrated by the inability to move into the career world. There were a lot of reasons why women seemed to be frustrated in America about this time. And eventually this sort of blew up. In the early 60s, feminism really caught hold, feminism as we now know it, and started to be a well-known... Yes? That's a good point. Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique in 1963. That is often seen as the catalyst to a larger social change. It was not a very prevalent thing. It had been born, but it hadn't grown up. In the intellectual centers in the East and so forth, feminism was already in full swing by the mid-60s, but it really didn't reach the broader community until a little bit later. And it wasn't until the 1970s that Mormonism began to be touched by this at all. One of the things that I did for my dissertation was that I reviewed all the speeches that had been given concerning women's roles by men or women from 1960 to 1990. And, it was interesting reading. In the church, yes. No, not in the world and everything in it. Yeah, and what I found was that the 1960s, it was still just absolutely traditional, and there was an assumption in these speeches that everyone agreed that all, you know, when you read the things in the New Era from that period or the Ensign or the conference reports, it was just assumed that what the women wanted most of all was, you know, to wrap themselves in cellophane and be waiting at the door with a chicken fried steak. It was a very stereotypical, traditional, what we now think of as a traditional view of the happy homemaker, what my students call a Molly Mormon. That was assumed right up through the early 70s. Now, in the early 70s, there was some rumbling going on. You started to see people addressing the issue of feminism in conference talks and so forth in a kind of wrist-slapping way, as though some irritating mosquito had flown in through the window and deserved to be squashed, you know. But it still wasn't considered to be a big issue. Then, as the economic structure of the United States changed, things really began to move. What happened economically is that the real wage power of the average salary earner dropped significantly in regard to the cost of living, so that all of a sudden it really did take the wife going into the workforce for a family to achieve the same standard of living they had had earlier with just the man working. And that really was a product of the economy. Now feminist writers are getting upset because they feel that feminists into sending women into the workforce just when they could supply the need for labor without increasing the absolute wage going to any single family. So there really was a difference in how much a family could, how well a family could live with just one wage earner. And that really kicked in the 70s. And women were all of a sudden pushed into the workforce a little bit by economic need. At the same time, the feminist movement had made enough inroads that structures were beginning to change politically to allow women more opportunity to go into the workforce. So you had an increase in the need to work, and at the same time there was an increase in the opportunity, and the result was that women began to move into the workforce, and there was a consequent change in their attitudes. Feminism began to grow very rapidly. It became very popularized, largely because people's economic circumstances were forcing them to think through those issues. And TV shows like All in the Family started to take the bull by the horns and so forth. And at that point, you start to see Ensign articles, conference reports. You see things, subtle things, like there are, all of a sudden there are women with briefcases on the covers of some of these magazines. And all of a sudden there will be a primary story about how little Sally learns to cook and thereby gains her father's love and self-esteem. But the reason she's doing it, which is, you know, marked in paragraph 3 in one sentence, is that mommy's had to go out to work. There are little things like that. They just start to creep in the 70s, and there's a sort of tacit acceptance throughout the 70s, and it's sort of building toward the late 70s and early 80s, of the fact that women were working. Mormon women were working. And then in the 80s, it really caught on. There was kind of an enormous relaxation. This is when I was just going off to Harvard. This is when I was being told I was a role model and everything. And in 87, just as I was being flown back to Provo to give a women's conference panel on combining careers and family, Ezra Taft Benson gave his famous address to the mothers in Israel, basically, you know, just laying it right on the table and saying, you've got to go back home. You know, working is inimical to your role as a mother and to your salvation and everything else. Caused a lot of uproar. A lot of women, though, essentially their reaction was to take a week off. one woman said that told me during the interview that her reaction to that talk was she was typing away listening at her job, listening to the radio, and she said she sort of stopped and thought and then kept typing. The economic conditions hadn't changed, and really neither had a lot of the attitudes surrounding these women in their daily lives. So that's sort of the pattern there. Back to the way that women feel about their work, those who were socialized during the period from 1940 to 1955 simply feel that their role, their rights, their identity is very much tied in with being a mother, a good mother, whose work is as valuable as any man's work and just as important in the eyes of God. Women who are in that age group who do work, either, number one, they had to for some reason, and they feel ashamed about it. In other words, they did never marry or have children, which was, of course, their only salient identity, so work was a poor second best. Or they had a husband who left them, which was much, much worse during that time period than it is now. The reasons that they went to work, they associate with failure in my interviews, and they feel ashamed. Or they wanted to work, they had high career aspirations, they felt like they were talented people with something to achieve, and they went to work even though social norms were so against it, and they are very defiant. Now, these are the women who are just, you know, there are some great elderly gray-haired ladies that I interviewed who are just about the feistiest feminists I've ever talked to in my life, because they had to be in order to work during that period of time with the socialization that they'd had growing up. So women in this category do work. They have to. They have to do it to support missionaries. Some of them are supplementing pensions. Some of them are widowed. Some of them just need more money because they have large families and their kids are now in school or by now. And they're out there working, but they still carry these feelings about it, either that it's a sort of a shameful thing or that it's a good thing, but the church doesn't like it, and I'm just going to defy the church. And I think this has something to do with the negative association between church activity and full-time work in women of that age group. That it has been, during their socialization, full-time work was very negative in the church, and if they did go to work full-time, they felt like they were being sort of emotionally assaulted at church, and they distanced themselves from it. Okay, the women who were socialized during the period of about 1955 to 1965, when they were in their growing up years, they still heard, because, as the sister said, the feminist movement hadn't really picked up any steam by then, they really felt that they were the same as the women who'd gone before them, that their traditional model was in place. Many women in this age group, 35 to 45-year-olds told me, I just sort of assumed I would grow up, have a big family, closer to the 40-year-old range now, actually, would tell me, I just never expected anything but that I would grow up, have 7 kids, and live a wonderful life. But these women feel gypped. They feel like the world changed out from under them just as they were making the sacrifices they thought were right. They feel, a lot of them now have children who are in sort of their high school years. They've spent their early adulthood raising these children while the whole world was changing to tell them that's not enough. You know, you don't have, is that all you do? You know? You mean you don't have a degree, you don't have a job, you don't have a career? And they feel bad about it. Now, the women who are older than they are, it didn't affect them so much. They were already very, very, mature and sure about themselves before the feminist movement started, and they basically just thought it was strange, a lot of them. But the women who are in the 40-year-old area tend to feel like they feel inadequate. They feel like everyone younger than them all of a sudden has careers. They feel like they have to somehow make up for this. I saw an enormous number of women in this age group going back to school. In my, I'm seeing nodding heads around the room, going back to get a career. It's like, well, I'm still young enough to do something. Some of them don't feel that they're young enough to do something, and they feel a little bit, they feel a sense of loss, that they still have a long life ahead of them, essentially. They're not past midlife, but they don't have the kind of careers and training and background that a lot of women in earlier, younger age groups do. So they feel very frustrated, and there's a sense of bitterness that they weren't told in time. Now, one woman I talked to who's now in law school, 42-year-old woman, just said, nobody told me when I was in high school. Nobody told me what was possible. Nobody told me what I should do. Nobody told me the way I'd be evaluated as I got older. You know, I thought having kids would be enough, and it isn't, and I'm frustrated too, and that's why she's in law school. That's a fairly typical pattern. Okay, then you have your 25 to 35-year-olds in my sample. These were the women who were being socialized during the period when feminism was a wonderful idea, but nobody'd really done it yet. Betty Friedan in Feminist Mystique says, it is not at all difficult to combine a career and family. All it takes is a good life plan. And she didn't have a career and family at the time, but it seemed to her theoretically that this should be true. Gloria Steinem felt the same way, and these two were at a dinner in 1990, and a woman came up to them during this press conference and grabbed Gloria Steinem by the lapels and said, why didn't you tell us it would be this hard? And Gloria Steinem, with admirable candor, responded, well, we didn't know. nobody had tried it. It sounded really good that we should be able to have wonderful careers and great big families and fulfill all the demands placed on both men and women in the past, that one individual could do it all, but nobody really tried it. Well, this was my period of socialization, and let me tell you, it was a shock for me when I tried to have it all and found out that you could have everything but sleep. It was really... Thank you. Everyone, take a nap. I think that's going to be my motto, take a nap. But it was a period where those in my age group went out into the world, very high educational aspirations, very high career aspirations, but also thinking that we could have a whole bunch of kids and just do great. And, our husbands would help us out and everything would be fine. And although there has been a real serious attempt by everyone to try to make it work, the fact is that a full-time career is full-time, and children, surprise, surprise, are full-time. And I saw a lot of very painful conflict going on in this age group. One that really comes to mind is a woman that I interviewed in Boston. This I thought about this in connection with Tim's finding that college-educated women without careers are the most likely to abuse their children. This woman was actually my visiting teaching companion. And she was planning to have 4 children. She did not want 4 children. And she was going to have them absolutely as fast as possible to get it out of the way. She was very bitter and resentful about it, but she told me over and over, I feel like I have to have at least 4 children to be viable as a Mormon. And it is, people are laughing, but this is, I felt a very strong pressure to have a certain number of children. I mean, 4 was the number for me, too. 4 or 5. It seemed like to be really a legitimate Mormon woman, you had to have at least 4 or 5 kids. When this woman did have her 4th child, she was so upset by having, she was absolutely beside herself with frustration. She had these 4 little tiny kids. And once when I went over to her apartment she'd placed this new baby in an empty bathtub where he was just screaming his little lungs out in this cold tile bathtub while she sat in the living room and tried to get some computer programming done because she wanted a job so badly. And she was so upset that her jaws had locked, which is I later learned is not an uncommon symptom of extreme tension. She was so conflicted because she genuinely felt that she had to be able to fulfill the plans she had for her career. Very brilliant woman, a Rhodes Scholar. She really felt that she had to fulfill her potential as an individual, but also had to fulfill this requirement that she have a huge family, or big. I think of four as huge now. And as a result, it was having a very negative effect on her children, I think. And but it was a common thing for people in my age group, and as I've gone through school, a lot of the people that I know feel this conflict a lot. Now, as I've come to BYU and started teaching people in a younger age group and interviewed some of them as well, what I see is that having experienced, having been taught about the conflict experienced by women a few years older, these women are a lot more savvy. These younger women tend to be more savvy. They do want it all, but they're aware of the fact that they will have to make compromises. And among those compromises are having flexible working hours and everything, but also reducing family size. Very important to the women that I've taught at BYU is choosing a man who will be sympathetic to them in a spousal arrangement so that they can work out compromises in marriage to accommodate both career and family. But I've seen a dramatic drop, at least impressionistically, in the number of children that these women are planning to have. So what this means for the future of the church in terms of the data that Tim's showing us are that, okay, we have a very high sense of value for both individual achievement and family in the church. And that is coming out in a split between the ideal and the real to this point. Ideally, women learn that they should be able to maximize their full potential, every talent, every skill, every opportunity for notoriety, and that will benefit the church and benefit their salvation, and that it will rise with them in the resurrection and whatever. And then on the other hand, you have still a very, very strong feeling the family is the most important, that a woman will never do any work as important as having children and raising them. And all these things are still accepted. What that means in practice, though, is that educationally, before they're actually thrust into working situations with children, Mormon women push harder than other women. They get more education. The more active they are, the more they feel like they should be well educated. I think it's part of fulfilling their divine potential. They are taught literally in church that it is a good thing for them to get education. And at the same time, when they go and get educated, they feel it doesn't necessarily, there may be things in the educational system that detract from their ability to be active church members, but our church corresponds well enough with what is being taught to them in terms of individualism, that in some ways their education reinforces their faith as well. So a very positive association between education and the church, and I think in the future Mormon women will continue to be more educated than the general population of women, and that educated Mormon women will continue to be more active, that active Mormon women will continue to get more education. On the other hand, in the work world, when you change from the ideal to the real, I think there's been a period of enormous disillusionment on the part of a lot of women, but they're coming around to that, to compromising, to being able to accommodate the realities of work, the economy, social pressures, and religious pressures, and they are accommodating that. In general, if you believe that all things are created spiritually before they're created physically, practice tends to conform to theory. And right now, I think the theory that people have in all these age groups, except maybe the oldest age group, is that women should be able to fulfill both sides of their potential, and that includes making high achievements in the rational workplace. Middle-aged women now are going back to school. Women in my age group are finding ways to work and family. Maybe limiting their family size a little bit before the women of the previous generation. The younger, the women who are younger still, I think, are having much smaller families and are going to work. They're well-trained, they're very ambitious, and they are going to work. And what you have, historically in the church, mass movement overrides advice. One of the things I found is that people expect me, I get calls from the press all the time expecting me to say that women are being booted from the church for breaking the rules, that women are being excommunicated for working, excommunicated for limiting their families, excommunicated for espousing feminist ideals or getting divorced. I talked to 300 women, and I did not find a single case of a structural reprimand, disfellowshipment or excommunication, against women who did these things. I found a lot of informal social sanctions, a lot of nasty looks, a lot of nasty comments, but I actually had women who felt so strongly about these things that they went in and asked to be excommunicated and were rejected. I really don't believe, I do believe that we're going to get a lot of exhortation, as we have already, for women to stay home, but the fact is that they aren't. Practice is coming to conform to theory, and so I expect that, again, we'll see a continuation of the trend that was already beginning in the 70s, which is that this highly educated group of women will continue to move into the workforce, that the younger women will find ways to work full-time sometimes, they will work part-time during the period that their children are young, that older women whose children are now a little bit older will start going into full-time careers. In short, that there will be an upsurge of career women in the LDS Church. This stuff was all, I really didn't think this until I looked at Tim's paper. But I think the data show that, and combined with my interviews, I think that supports it. So expect to see this in the future, and if it doesn't, come back and talk to me. We'll have some interviews, and I'll just revise my theory. I think we're open for comments now and questions. Yeah? Why don't we share the pulpit here? You were first, I think. I'd like to clarify that a little bit. I think it's what they felt they could rightfully expect from life. I think it's a combination of both. I think when you come into a group of 10-year-olds and say, why don't you be a nuclear physicist? Why don't you be a doctor? Why don't you be a writer? They feel, number one, that they're getting incentive from outside themselves to achieve this goal. Number two, they may internalize part of that. They may genuinely want it, and then it becomes an internalized goal. So it's both. Okay, I'm going to repeat the question for the tape and for those of you who didn't hear. The question, as I understand it, is that authoritative discourse, the official pronouncements of the church, speak out very directly and clearly against women having careers or choosing careers over family. Yet, women do not seem to be following that counsel in general in the church. And there seems to be some sort of schism between what is being taught officially and what is actually being done. And I believe the question regarded how do women reconcile that? Or is that it? Okay. So,
I'd like to comment.
Great. I want to talk a bit about what the authoritative discourse is doing, and I think you could. You were the one that reviewed it, but my sense is that up through the early 80s, there was a consistent statement: women should be at home, and that in the early 80s there began to be some modification about that. Of saying, yes, we recognize some women need to work, with the exception of the 1987 presentation by Ezra Taft Benson. And that what's interesting is the silence that occurred around that talk. That is, that no one else, and we're talking about other patriarchs, picked up that theme. Now, I've heard that theme raised again, but I've heard it raised by women who are continuing to speak it to women. So, I would argue that there are a number of things changing, and the authoritative discourse is changing, not as quickly and as fast as the women are changing themselves, but there is some interesting thing changing about that discourse.
Thanks. I think that's really true. I have a response to that too, and that is, there was a study done in Canada regarding attitudes versus behavior of various religious denominations concerning gender roles. They looked at fundamentalist Christians, Baptists, Protestants, non-Christians, and Mormons. Mormons was a separate category, specifically because of our, quote, well-known position on women's roles. And what they found was that Mormons came out looking the most fundamentalist of everybody, including fundamentalist Christians, on this survey in terms of their attitudes toward gender. Then when you look at what people are actually doing, they're some of the most liberal. I mean, they're equally liberal with people like Protestants. And so what they concluded from that was Mormonism has the greatest schism between what is expressed and what is actually done. I think that's regrettable, quite frankly. I really do. I think that it's very easy in Mormonism to get up. I talked to many women. I remember interviewing one woman who had just given this bang-up presentation on being a perfect homemaker. She had this like this huge wooden chart with little hooks, and she'd like assigned everyone their daily duties. They had little felt pouches with pictures on them and everything. It was just amazing. And I, in the interview, she said, "That was my daughter's. I've never done anything like that. I was raised in a house with servants, and you know, I never did any housework." But she felt a very strong pressure to espouse, to appear to be a good homemaker. And she really thought that everyone else in the room probably was a good homemaker. I don't think it's malicious, but I think there is a woeful gap between what is actually being practiced and what's being preached in the church. And all I can say is that more openness would help.
As Marie said, other than the one talk by Ezra Taft Benson, I haven't heard statements since then from the pulpit as much saying women shouldn't work. On the other hand, that is the message my daughter gets in Young Women's, not because they say women shouldn't work, but because all they say is you should be married and have children. And I read the situation sort of like in the mid-70s. That is, there had been statements on birth control, that Mormons, good Mormons, didn't use birth control. Most of them did, and maybe felt guilty about it. By the 1990s, now, I, as far as I can tell, they don't feel guilty about using birth control, and they all do. I'm reading this situation with working the same way. That is, that we will have very few explicit statements saying women don't work, but that women will feel guilty about it for the next 20 years. But I don't know. Is that fair to say?
I agree, yeah. I don't know who to call on next. There are so many hands up. You got a choice, anybody?
Greta.
The question was what is the role of the women's auxiliaries in presenting the role of women and how and changes in that, particularly in light of the fact that the current Relief Society presidency includes some very prominent and in one case career women. First of all, the women's auxiliaries have very little real power in terms of changing the structure in the church, even to the very top levels. But secondly, they are figureheads and role models, and I don't think it was accidental that Chieko Okazaki was called to the presidency when she has, in fact, been a school principal, as you said. I spoke to her once, and she told me she got up finally in a conference one day and said, "I've worked all my life, and I've never felt guilty about it." And she got letters saying, "How could you say such a thing?" So she said, "I thought about it really hard, and the next time I said, you know, I've worked all my life, and I've never felt guilty about it, and I've tried, but I can't even feel guilty about that." To have such women in place in the leadership of the church signals, I think, that the church is aware both of the contributions that highly accomplished women can make, and that there is, again, that kind of tacit acceptance of a woman making personal choices. The one clear thing is that these choices are directed by spiritual means. And that's what I found in my interviews about the way women do reconcile their different career choices, is that to remain active in the church and make choices which seem inimical to the church teachings requires a very strong reliance on spirituality versus religiosity. So there's a very strong appeal to personal revelation, to inner feelings about one's mission in life. I think that's happening in the women's auxiliaries, as it is everywhere in the church. Any comment?
woman in the blue here.
Actually, there was a very strong push for this a couple of years ago in Harvard Business Review. A well-known writer published an article which came to be labeled the mommy track, saying that it should just be accepted that women are going to stay home with their children and that employers should make provisions for keeping women on professional career tracks while giving them flexible time and reduced hours during their the early childhood of their offspring. And it met with incredible opposition from the feminists around Harvard at the time, probably around the country, because it implied that women would take a less invested career track than men, who were automatically seemed to be free of these child-rearing duties. And so there's been a real attempt. The ideology of feminism, which is that all people should be equal, doesn't really take into account the fact that structurally women are still responsible for the rearing of children. And this will still have to be worked out in the corporations and in the legalities, but there is a movement toward it. There's been a lot of resistance, but I think politically and legally you're going to start seeing much, much more of that. So all we can do is wait.
But I see the strain created for Mormon women there is that that as long as men also have to have that heavy-duty responsibility in church positions, particularly the same men who have the heavy-duty responsibility in management, that effort of Mormon women to try and balance out the responsibilities in the family, it's sort of a double indemnity sort of thing. I mean, you know, you just hit twice with it in trying to equal that out because of you get it both at church and with the corporation.
Okay, the question is, how's the church been dealing with the overall increase in the number of women who have been forced into poverty by social changes in the recent past and who now have very limited career options? The gentleman commented that we've been talking about people as though they have the choice of going out and having some marvelous professional career or staying home and having some marvelous marriage, which is pretty much the dual image you get in the role models presented in the church. At the same time, the church has absorbed some of the ideology that says that women should be able to support themselves equally in the workforce and should not be given welfare benefits. This is really just a mirror of what's going on in the broader society, and it has to do with the fact that the idea of individual equality has not been reconciled with the idea of the family being the unit of society. Again, I'm going to go back to that whole thing in the Declaration of Independence, that people are seen as individual and as having individual accomplishments and individual goals and in equal ability to achieve personally. At the same time, there are these structures which are assumed in our society but which are very highly valued that put the family as the first, as the unit of society, as the first line of emotional defense for most people and put the woman in a very specific spot in that group. And in the broader society, it was things that have helped lead to the feminization of poverty, as it's been called, are things that were designed to liberate women to some extent. All of a sudden, women are seen as being able to earn their own money rather than as being necessarily dependent on a man. Therefore, you get things like legal changes such as no-fault divorce, which assumes that a woman and a man at the dissolution of a marriage, you know, if they're both 35, college-educated, they both have equal opportunity to make a living. And that's an equal law. That was pushed by feminists because it treats men and women equally. But the structures of society treat men and women differently. Most women, I think, would fight to keep their children at divorce. The ones that I interviewed did. Most people would assume that children, when they're small, belong with their mothers. The job structure still is not as inviting to women as to men. Therefore, when a divorcing couple goes out and they're given equal opportunities, a man's income goes up 42% in the first year after a divorce, and the woman's income goes down 72%. These are what some feminists have called the unexpected consequences of putting out egalitarian policies. ERA is another example. If we treat men and women absolutely equally in the workforce, what do we do when parenthood arrives? Well, the man's not going to ask for sick leave because he's throwing up every morning for 5 months. You know, it's the woman whose body changes at pregnancy, and therefore, if under the law they're treated equally, the woman simply isn't pulling her weight because we make no special exceptions for pregnancy. So there are these contradictions between treating people as absolute individuals and accommodating the very real differences biologically and socially that we've inherited from our genes and from our society, and the church is picking up on that. The answer has been to say, well, women get back in the home. It was all working fine when we had this traditional system. If we just all go back to the farm where my mother was and everything was great, you know, we'd just go out and milk the cows. In other words, a retrenchment to a pre-modern style of living where people could be self-sufficient. There hasn't been any answer arrived at except that, except to try to turn back the clock and go back in history. It isn't working, and I don't think it can work. What do you think, Tim?
But I have to pass along a comment I heard from married student housing at BYU. One person was asked to give a lesson on encouraging education for women because in the ward someone made the comment. And that, now, let me set the context. A lot of women had gotten married and stopped going to college at BYU after they were married. The comment was made, women don't need an education because they're going to be gods. So,
oh, God, no education.
It's not important now because eventually whatever we learn in college will be mostly irrelevant, right? What reminded me of this? Well, many people at the local level are using the facts you're talking about, the feminization of poverty, the fact that at least half of women in the church now at some point in their adult years will be responsible for themselves and probably a family, are using that as a sort of backdoor way to encourage more schooling and career preparation for women. I would hope that we could move that a step farther and instead of simply saying don't work, saying how can work, since a large majority of women will work, how can work be supportive of family life? And in the cases you're talking about, it's very clear that a mother who's responsible for children will be able to do that much better if she can provide a living. And I think we ought to start looking at that and other ways to say work can support a family and help a family and make a family better.
I just want to add to that and point out the particular problem we have here in the state of Utah because the gender gap in wages nationally has been on the increase. I mean, depending on the report you look at, nationally it's somewhere around 71 cents on the dollar for women, up from 65% a decade or so ago. The women in Utah have not experienced that same kind of benefit. And part of, so what you're saying here is that, I mean, everything that both Tim and Martha said in terms of the no-fault divorce laws and the expectation of women to help support families creates a real bind in Utah because when the woman does go out and work, the difference between what she'll make and what her husband will make or what she'll make and what her male colleague will make is greater in Utah than in other places. One of the reasons for that, I think, is the history we've had of women not being educated, not encouraged to finish that college degree. You know, women getting to the age where they have teenage kids, their choice is to go back to school or to send their oldest daughter to school. And if you have that choice, then you take a low-paying job to get your daughter through school, not to put you through school and put your sons on missions. So I think what we're, part of the issue is somehow helping the economy in Utah other than in the service sector, you know, the service industry where all the low-paying jobs are. And the other thing is to help increase the level of education of women, to make sure they are educated and prepared. Because the gender gap does change as women get more qualified.
Another thing I think is making it acceptable within the church and the women slowly.
Oh, I don't think...
Okay.
No way. We are not making it okay for professional women.
Well, we are. We put people on general boards and that kind of thing.
It's decreased markedly.
Is it decreased?
Oh, absolutely. Major. Oh, he wanted to know about the attrition rate at BYU for women. Maybe you know that better than I do. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
But one of the things, there's sort of a funny story behind this, because one of the things that was happening at BYU is they were discovering that they were able to, you know, there's an enrollment cap at BYU, and they were discovering that for some reason they couldn't accept as many students as they used to in the last in the past, and they discovered one of the reasons was that it was taking longer to finish for students to finish. But the other thing they discovered is that the number of women who were staying at the university to complete their degrees doubled over like a 6-year period. And so what's happening is that women are staying in school at BYU, and it's created a bottleneck in enrollment. But we're glad that that's happening, and we hope that that's a trend for Mormon women generally. Oh, I think, do you have something else to say?
Over 40% of the baccalaureate degrees now are awarded to women at BYU, which was certainly not true a decade ago.
No, recently it's 50%.
Is it over 50?
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was 100.
It's like 48-51 now. If you take, at a particular ceremony, half of them, almost half, are women. I don't have any information on that. I mean, if you look in the sociology department, most of the graduate students in the sociology department, certainly at the master's level, are women these days. So, anyway, we need to. It's 12:45. Thank you very much. Thank you, Tim and Martha.